The Secret Origins Podcast, Episode 4.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Secret Origins Podcast. I'm your host, DFG and Mike, and joining me on this journey is Lupus Convoy. Hello, sir.
Hello, good sir. How are you?
I'm doing fairly well. How are you is the better question.
I am recovering from a pretty bad car accident.
Oh, I'm sorry, dude. What happened?
We've been having some pretty bad storms up here in New England. I'm sure everyone's had some really bad storms. Mind you, it's not as bad as DC, but a gentleman apparently blacked out and lost control of his vehicle and went over 4 lanes of highway. And I could not stop fast enough and ended up colliding with him and bouncing him off of the side that he was going to be hitting on a bridge. And it totally demolished my little Volkswagen Beetle.
Oh, wow.
So Cliff Jumper is dead. It didn't take Megatron. It took a really bad New England storm.
Poor Casey Kasem.
I know. It'll never be the same.
Are you alright, though?
Some minor whiplash, neck, cervical stuff, but I'm recovering.
That's good.
And I'm sorry for everyone that might have missed me on any other podcasts. Because I'm really funny when I'm on drugs. medical drugs.
He says that now, ladies and gentlemen. He says that now.
Yeah, because most of the time everyone sits there and goes, is he awake? And I go, nah, nah. So, yeah.
Well, that's better than Steve Megatron, you know, when we end up recording late and he ends up falling asleep. He just turns into Darth Vader. It's like, okay, we don't need Darth Vader here. Thank you very much. Today we will be reviewing 3 more stories from Justice League. Do we have anything else we want to say in this little intro clip?
I like vanilla ice cream. Just putting that out there.
Okay then, let's get into some episodes.
Allow us to introduce ourselves. Justice Guild, roll call.
Catman.
Black Siren.
Green Guardsman.
Tom Turbine.
The Streak.
Yeah. I'm Green Lantern, that's Flash, Hawkgirl, and John Jones.
And this is our official Justice Guild Junior Justice Guildsman, Ray Thompson.
When I grow up, I'm gonna be a crime fighter.
So long as you remember to eat right and stay in school.
Right.
Jean, what's wrong?
A sudden dizziness. So strange.
Nothing a tall, cold glass of milk won't cure.
I think I have some freshly baked cookies, too.
Let's let the men talk.
They can talk all they like.
Could you excuse us for a sec?
I will not be patronized.
We need answers here. So maybe, just this once, we can all play along.
So, you fight crime and bake cookies. How do you do it?
While we're waiting, this can't be real.
Tell me about it. I almost busted a gut during that roll call routine.
It's not that. It's the Justice Guild. They're comic book characters.
Okay, so we're going to start off with the first episode that we're going to cover, and that's Legends Part 1. And in Part 1, Metropolis is in awe. Several Justice Leaguers are fighting a giant robot secretly controlled by Lex Luthor from a remote location. It is eventually destroyed when Superman tears it open and Batman destroys its reactor with a batarang. Following the explosion, the Flash creates a whirlwind so as to prevent the robot from falling over his teammates. However, he reaches such a high speed that he inadvertently transports Jon Stewart, Jean, Hawkgirl, and himself into an alternate Earth that resembles an idyllic 1950s town.
Pleasantville!
That's what I thought. After John prevents a villain from stealing a violin, the League members are mistaken for villains by the Justice Guild of America, the resident superhero team. The Green Guardsman, Black Siren, the Streak, Tob Turbine, and Catman fight the Leaguers, but they cease once the Flash saves their youthful sidekick, Ray Thompson, from being crushed. The Justice Guild makes the four Justice League members honorary members of their... Tom Turbine explains to the Leaguers the theory of infinite number of alternate universes, each having its own vibrational pattern. He believes that Flash's speed is what caused them to come to their Earth. However, John feels that something is wrong. He remembers the heroes from the comic books of his childhood, but never knew that they were real people. John theorizes that the creators of the comics must have had a subconscious link to this Earth. What they thought was creativity was actually Flash's the Guild's real exploits. Tom Turbine unveils his interdimensional portal he designs, but lacks a proper energy source to help them return home. While waiting for it to happen, the Justice League fights along with the Guild against the Injustice Guild, a group of supervillains that run afoul of the Justice Guild, because that's normally how it works. However, the Leaguers begin to notice flaws in the world. The ice cream truck passing through never stops. Jean starts seeing haunting images of the city being destroyed, and Hawkgirl and Lantern discovered that all the books in the library are empty covers. They also notice that the two police officers that they have seen patrolling the city are the only ones around. When they try to stop the ice cream man to question him, he acts scared and drives off in a hurry, saying that he might be watching. Trouble also seems to happen when they get too close to the truth. Finally, the Leaguers, starting with Hawkgirl, discovers the graves of the Justice Guild. Any thoughts?
Yeah. The beginning of this, like, I love Hawkgirl, don't get me wrong. She's great, but she had a blonde moment. Who could be behind this monstrosity like that? My reply, it's green and purple. Hello, Lex Luthor. Come on now. It's not actually ever said that it is Lex, but we do see his face. We do see partial of his cheek and his evil grin. And it's green and freaking purple. That's what his freaking suit is made out of. The little kryptonite thingamajigger bobber that we saw a few episodes ago.
True.
Oh, God.
But it could also be a very colorblind, insane toy maker. I don't know.
No, Spider-Man comes later.
True, but it's one of those. It could be someone that's insanely colorblind. I don't know.
Yeah. Throughout this two-parter, I'm probably going to be bringing up Adam West Batman a lot, because that's what yes. It felt like to me was 1966.
Holy jinkies, Catman!
Yeah, exactly. Plus, the Music Master drives a flute. How fucking cool is that?
Okay. The first time I saw him, mind you, I haven't seen this episode since it first aired. So I saw this, and I was like, what the hell's the Music Meister doing there?
Yeah, it's not Meister, it's Master.
Okay, same thing.
No, I know what you're getting at, but...
Was this the original idea behind the Music Meister later on, or because it looked really, really similar.
I'm not sure. I think all of these designs, both the Justice Guild and the Crime Syndicate, were takeoffs of the Justice Society of America. Yep. and their villains. They could not do it direct. The DC would not let them do a direct representation. So they had to change it up a little bit. Unfortunately... Oh, no, you have Season 1 on Blu-ray, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Isn't there the commentary on Legends Part 2?
There is. I need to rewatch that then.
You watch that then, because Bruce Timm talks about that on the commentary.
I want to know what the actual reasoning behind them not being able to use JSA characters.
I think,
so
like
they
I said,
had the right to use all of the DC catalog.
Well, you know, it's funny. Michael Powers from the Lunch Table and myself and Steve Megatron last night recorded Geekcast Radio Episode 9, where the topic was how network television has gone down the tubes, at least in my own opinion it has. And I know this is way off the subject of this episode, but we started talking about DCAU and Warner Brothers and DC Comics. Why Warner Brothers owns DC. Why can't they use their characters in certain things? And at this time, when Justice League was on, there was a huge bat embargo on... That's why a lot of the Batman villains aren't in Justice League, save Joker. And now, I don't know the whole story behind it. I'm not really sure, but like I said, go back and listen to that commentary on the... I think it's either Legends Part 1 or Part 2. I forget which one it is. But there's a commentary with Bruce Timm, James Tucker, I think Paul Dini, I'm not sure. There's a commentary. Go listen to it. when Tom Turbine arrives, the look on Flash's face is just priceless. He has this like, cringing look on his face. Just the animation of Flash was just so priceless to me. It was like one of those MasterCard commercials or something.
Yeah, it's. I love Flash's face. Like he was so animated in this. Yeah. God, that was a bad choice of words, but he was definitely... It's kind of like akin to watching the Transformers movie and seeing the Brontosaurus get, like, slammed, and his eyes are very cartoony, and, his body's, like, 20 feet below. His eyes are still up there, like he's stuck out of a Looney Tunes commercial.
Poor Sludge. this will actually be my next... hopefully, if I can get the audio correct when I go back and get the audio for this episode, for this episode of the podcast, this next note that I have will actually be the quote of the episode: "Fastest man alive with a limp."
Limp. That was awesome.
I so wish I could get Maria Canales. I think her last name is her because she added a name. She got married. I think it's spelled pronounced Baera. I'm not sure. I might have to watch some more Disney Channel to find out, but I would love to get an interview with her just to get Hawk Girl sound bites.
That would be awesome.
Yes, that would be so freaking cool. As I said before, can you say 1966 Batman feel when the sergeant shows up?
It was.
It's like, you know, it's Commissioner Gordon all over again, Batman. You know? Like, wow. Some of the bad puns in this episode: Chill Gotten Gains. Give me a break. That's so corny. I mean, I know that that's what they were going for, and I really don't have a problem with it. This episode, or this story, this two-parter, is actually very, very good. And then, again with the cliffhangers, the JGA is dead, because it ends right there.
Dun, dun, dun.
With showing the graves, and I just love how Tim and company pulled off the pacing, regardless if there's bad episodes. I just love the way they pull off the pacing of the ending of each first part of a two-parter, because it just flows so well.
It does. It's got a lot of really good. You don't have those slow moments with these episodes, or the feeling like there's this whole slowdown that they could have done a lot more with it, or crammed a bit more story.
Yeah. What are your other thoughts on the first part here?
Oh, God. Okay, so in the beginning part of the episode, when we've got the Justice League, and we're seeing some really good teamwork out of them. Like, we've seen good teamwork before, but this just epitomized why they are the Justice League and why they are so damn good at what they do.
Right.
Because, you know, they're not going, oh, let's send out the Flash, and then, okay, he failed, now let's throw in Wonder Woman. It was like they're all doing their own little components and totally trashing this robot. And the robot, I might add, it's ripped right out of Evangelion. It's got all the design schema of it, even to the point where it's got the shoulder blades sticking straight up in the air like fins, and the four eyes from Ava Unit 2.
Okay, I know I'm probably going to get kicked in the ass for this, but what the hell are you talking? What is Evangelion? I don't even, you know.
Evangelion is a Japanese anime that was extremely controversial and had really bad pacing.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's probably why I don't know about it, because I don't watch Japanime.
But, okay, so they blow up the reactor in the robot. I fail to understand why Lex's boat gets blown up because of that. It should have been like, oh, connection lost or something, not, oh, boom, there goes Lex out of the boat, you know?
Well, you know, and again, we haven't, and you know, I know that you don't, or you haven't paid attention to a lot of the other series within the DCU, or DCAU, like BTAS and STAS, but the running gag with the DC Animated Universe is if you just punch a computer or a telephone, it will explode. if you go on YouTube, not right now, obviously, but later after we do this, if you go on YouTube and search for Superman the Animated Series Episode 1 or whatever, The Last Son of Krypton Part 3, I believe. Because there was a three-parter that introduced the Superman series. You look for The Last Son of Krypton Part 3 of Superman the Animated Series. At the very end, there's a confrontation where Superman is floating outside of Lex's window. And after they have their little exchange, Lex just takes his fist and just slams it right down on his phone, and the phone explodes.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So there are things within the DC Animated Universe that just don't make sense. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. What else have we got? There was a lot of really cool scenes with Sean. Just when he was doing the whole mind tricks in this, and I really liked how Sean was portrayed in this episode, as opposed to another episode we'll talk about later.
Yeah, I think you and I will pretty much agree on that episode point. Later.
Something that we've already talked about, some of the best lines that we've got out of Hawkgirl, who was just absolutely taken back by the fact that she's kind of looked down at because she's female.
Yeah.
Like, oh, let's go get some cookies. You make cookies and save the world. How do you do it?
I meant to go back and look at that scene because I think Black Siren puts her arm around Hot Girl's waist.
She does.
Okay. All right.
I caught that.
I could have sworn I caught it. I meant to go back and make sure, but and just rewind that part of the episode, but I didn't. But yeah.
Yeah, it was very like, oh, okay.
Draw your own conclusions, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, exactly.
I will say, though, as a kid, you probably would not get this when you're watching this.
True.
But you're looking at this and you're seeing the huge change in cultural shift. Like, you've got the comment from the Green Guardsman. Was it Green Guardsman? Someone to John, the Green Lantern, saying, you know, oh, you're a credit to your people. And most people would not get that if you're from the 2000 on generation.
Yeah.
It probably would not have hit. But between that and the sexism that is brought up, you can see a major huge cultural shift going on between the era that they're talking about and that they're stuck in and what we're dealing with in the time period that they're from.
Right.
Like, even to the point where Jean is saying, I would hasten to say no to the child. I don't want to put him in harm's way. And Catman's like, come on, little buddy. Get in the little sidecar. Forget the helmet. Come on. It was kind of shocking, actually.
Yeah, it is. You're right. It is. It's actually very shocking.
And the stereotypes they've got going on with this, like, even to the point with the Irish cops, it's like, really? Ow. I mean, I'm only half Irish, but that kind of hurts.
Well, you know, again, like I said, like I said before, it reminded me of 1966 Batman. That sergeant reminded me of Commissioner Gordon from the 1966 Batman show. Or, oh god, I know people are screaming at their iPods right now. What the hell's the name of the damn deputy commissioner, or whatever the hell his name is? The one that did have the Irish accent in 66 Batman. O'Hara, that's what it was. Yeah. Sergeant O'Hara. You know, again, and I think that's the homage that they were going for there, yeah.
What else? I've got the Dakota Rings.
Uh-huh.
I remember Dakota Rings when I was a kid.
But, so do I.
The Flash going, ooh, nice plastic. Like they had plastic in the 1960s. So, for some reason I wrote down, the magic mace holds no power over music, because it just didn't work when she was fighting Music Master.
Yeah, no.
I love the fact that she was just going to blow up, like, the Orville Wright plane. In essence, that's what they were going for.
Yeah.
And then the thing that I've noticed lately in these episodes is that we've already got the background for Batman, and we've got the background for Superman. It seems like we're seeing a lot of background for Green Lantern, especially in this episode.
Right.
And it was really kind of nice to see when he's describing talking with was it his grandfather or his uncle? His uncle that had like the huge comic book collection, and they would spend the weekends just reading and enjoying that. And it's nice that we can see things like that in the comics, because normally we see a lot of characters coming from broken households or things like that, where they don't really instill that type of like, okay, yes, good, this is what a good family is kind of like. It was really nice to see that he comes from a really solid kind of home set, and where he's coming from as a person and why these characters mean so much to him.
Right. Oh yeah, exactly.
So I think that's all I got, other than the ending, which we've already touched on. It made me go, it's the others! It's the others!
Yeah.
Where's Nicole Kidman?
Right. Yeah. I'm just looking at the DCAU wiki here. The real names of the JGA members as seen in their tombstones are nods to the DC Comics counterparts' real identities.
Yep.
And Guardsman's real name is Scott Mason. The Golden Age Green Lantern is Alan Scott. Black Siren's real name is Donna Nance. Black Canary is Dinah Lance. Catman's name was T. Blake. His name of Batman Rogue was Thomas Blake, more commonly known as Catman. And Wildcat's first name is Ted Grant, so the T may be for either one. Likewise, the Injustice Guild is a lampoon of the Injustice Society, the rivals of the Justice Society in the comics. The Music Master was based off of the Fiddler. Sportsman was Sportsmaster, Dr. Blizzard was the Icicle, and Sir Swami was the Wizard. So there's your answer, but you still should go back and listen to that commentary.
I shall.
To hear them go about that. I was looking for something for this, I don't remember what the hell it was. I went to the wiki for something. Oh, the voice actors. You had, just awesome voice actors, but for the 1950s people, you had Corey Burton as Dr. Blizzard, the ice cream truck driver, and the mayor. Black Siren was Jennifer Hale. Neil Patrick Harris was Ray Thompson.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which I think, I don't remember, I remember listening to World's Finest Podcast, and Michael David Sims and James Doe commented that the Ray Thompson character is a homage to crap. I think it's two comic book writers, I think. I'm not sure. I don't know. Jeffrey Jones played Sir Swami. William Catt played Green Guardsman. Udo Kier played Music Master. Ted McGinley played Tom Turbine. Ted McGinley, people. Oh boy. Jefferson from Married with Children.
Oh, okay.
just overall, this first part was very well told. They, you know, every time they kept getting closer and closer, things would always start to happen, and that will unravel as we get into part two.
Are we ready for part two?
Yes.
Okay. So in part two, Jean later discovers that the whole city is an illusion. In this universe years ago, Seaboard City was destroyed during the Cuban Missile Crisis that started World War III. Ray Thompson, after being exposed to the fallout, developed...
We haven't had World War III yet. You mean World War II?
Maybe, but this says World War III.
Well, that's wrong. You mean World War II. Sorry to correct you, but that's what you mean.
Okay. Where was I? Right, so Ray Thompson, after being exposed to the fallout, developed powerful psionic powers. When Jean mind probes Ray, he reveals his true form, that of a hideous mutant. Ray decides to create a new city based on his childhood, complete with his favorite heroes. In reality, they died during the catastrophe, thus ended the Justice Guild. Thus, the end of the Justice Guild brought the end of the comic.
Yep.
However, the real inhabitants of the city are still terrified of Ray. The Leaguers battle Ray, but are outmatched by his powers. The Guild hesitates, realizing that defeating Ray will end their existence, then they decide it doesn't matter and join the League. Together, they manage to strain Ray to his limits, knocking him out. Without his concentration, the city disappears, and so does the Guild, and the ruins of a destroyed city appear. The survivors emerge, having been stuck in the fantasy world for 40 years, vowing to rebuild their city while the Leaguers build a while the Leaguers use a device built by Tom Turbine to return home, powered by Lantern's ring. Back in the real world, Lantern is mourning the deaths of his heroes. He says it doesn't make sense when they weren't real to begin with. Hawkgirl says they still sacrificed themselves to help the League, and that was reason enough to mourn them.
You know, and I know a lot of people have brought this up. I've read it on the DCAU wiki. John, I'm sorry. Sometimes John Stewart is not only a mean jerk, he's a dumbass. He has okay, now, maybe people out there can correct me, maybe you can correct me. He has the equivalent to the power cosmic that the Silver Surfer uses. Okay? He has this giant-ass power ring. And in episode 1, when Tom Turbine shows them the thing that they're working on, yes, granted, I know they're going to stay and help, you know, help their world, but why the hell didn't he just do it then? Why didn't he just power the thing in the, you know, when they first saw the little time doohickey machine gateway, Stargate SG-1 reference or whatever? You know?
I think it was, I mean, from their viewpoint, they don't know what specifically what type of energy source they needed because Tom didn't specify.
True.
So maybe they're thinking like nuclear reactor or something along those lines. So it was one of those, oh, maybe we'll just give it a shot.
I hope you have notes for this one, because I have exactly 3 notes. Can you say again, bat phone from 1966 Batman?
Yes. I'm like, if you look at it from my perspective, I'm like, why exactly would you put a glass dome over an emergency phone? Like, break glass to use the phone?
Seriously? No, they lifted it up.
I know, but in case of emergency, you know.
Right, yeah. How the hell did Catman turn the bike around inside the elevator?
I thought that, too.
How the hell...
That's one hell of a big elevator.
That's one hell of a small-ass bike. I mean, damn. And of my last note was the deformed Ray gives new meaning to the term ugly ass kid.
Oh, I agree there.
granted, I know he was part of the nuclear fallout and he got mutated by that and everything else, but damn,
that's the people though.
That is one gross kid though.
In comparison to how he was reacting in the normal child form.
Mm-hmm.
It was all like dancing around, happy, you know, clapping his hands like he's normal. And then we see his real form. I'm like, how exactly is he able to maneuver himself that way?
I don't
know. It just didn't seem to make sense logistically.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can only do so much with illusions, I would think, but...
Oh, no.
Let's see, what else do I have here? Did you catch the ads on the billboards?
I think so, but you're going to have to remind me.
One of them said, "Hey kids, go chew gum."
Yeah, I did catch that one.
I'm like, that's pretty bad. I mean, even for that time period, that's really blatant advertising. So, I mean, I'm not expecting this to be historically accurate in any way, shape, or form. So, I thought it was just kind of like, huh, well, that's interesting. I have down Alice in Wonderland references by Hawkgirl. I don't know how long she's been stuck on Earth, but she's going curiouser and curiouser.
Yeah.
It's kind of an Earth culture thing.
Yes.
What else? So, Jean did something that was insanely evil in my viewpoint.
Okay.
Like, something that really kind of crossed a line. He phased into the kid's head. Like, he put himself into the physical...
Oh, yeah, his hands, yeah.
And it was like, okay, is he going to phase out and take out the kid's brain?
Ew.
That's nasty. Really bad.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know to what point they were going towards with that, but I mean, we've seen some really nasty comics where phasers have done that and just completely killed people by removing people's brains that way.
Yeah, that's very, very bad.
I mean, maybe it's different for a Martian. I don't know. Maybe it's the same as, you know, giving someone a wet willy. But that made me stop and go, oh my god, what the hell is he doing? Jean, that's not cool, dude.
Yeah, that's not cool at all.
Ah, what else? Yeah, the entire time I'm like, they don't even have Diana in the background when they get back to the...
Oh, you know what? I don't even think I noticed her. I might have noticed her in the very first episode in the battle with Lex.
I didn't even see her then.
She might not have been. Well, that's another thing we need to bring up. Most likely we'll bring it up when we do the final recap of the entire podcast. But throughout the first and second season, I believe...
They cycle people in and out.
Where the hell are the other ones when they're not... doing adventure type stuff, but
I'm guessing Bahamas.
Well, in GL and Hot Girl's case, they're probably having hot wing sex.
Your God. Well, we know.
You like some buffalo hot sauce with those?
Oh God. Oh dear, that hurts.
Oh damn, I can't believe I came up with that. That's so awesome. But one of the things I like about this, and again, it's something that you're going to have to go back and watch in the new Batman Adventures and Superman the Animated Series, is that you mentioned earlier of the fact that we've gotten so much of Batman and Superman's, you know, backstory or whatever. They had pretty much really rotten chemistry back when they first met, and they still kind of do now at this point in the series. But I like in the beginning where Superman's ripping open the Lex suit. He's like, "All right, Batman, you're gonna have one shot at this, so you better make it count, because if you don't, we're all fucking dead or something."
Get right at the same time, it's like, it's the Batman.
Yeah, it's the goddamn Batman. He never misses.
Of course not. Oh, what else do I've got? Is it the end of the episode? It's like, aww.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Hawk Girl.
Yep.
This is the and then part. I think the funniest thing I had to be the nuns and the dynamite.
Yeah.
The nuns and the dynamite. They're like, oh, we're all going to die. Ooh.
Yep.
It just, that just made me laugh insanely out loud. I'm like, oh, haha.
Yeah.
Never mind, like, Green Lantern's like, okay, I saved them. Or, not Green Lantern, the Flash is like, yay, I saved them. I'm not going to pay attention to where I'm driving now. And that's all I've got for this episode.
Okay, we will be moving on.
She's been here, but she doesn't have the stone yet. How can you be sure? Get down! Jason, the door! It's sealed shut! There are too many of them. Gone, gone, the form of man. Rise, the demon Etrigan. You could have warned me.
Next up, we have Night of Shadows, Part 1. And we start off with a prologue, and it's set in medieval England, and Camelot is under siege by an army of demons commanded by the sorceress Morgane Le Fay. Inside the castle, a knight named Jason Blood secretly opens a gate, letting her forces in. She embraces him as her love, and then gives him a poisonous kiss that cripples him. As chaos envelops the castle, Merlin looks down at Jason and remonstrates. For his selfish and misguided love, he has doomed Camelot. Merlin curses Jason with immortality and possession by the demon Etrigan, never to rest until he has defeated Le Fay and atoned for his crime. In modern day, a feeble elderly man is wheeled out of a rare bookshop. While Batman is investigating, Jason approaches him. The two men have met before. Jason explains that Morgan is seeking the Philosopher's Stone that Merlin hid from her. It will give her the ultimate power she needs to conquer the world and give the kingdom to her young son, Mordred.
Now, I need to give you some backstory on this. They met back in Batman the Animated Series, the Demon Within episode.
Okay. I think I've seen that.
Okay, well, that's where, just to bring everybody else up to speed, that's how Batman knows Jason.
What's the goddamn Batman? He knows everyone.
True.
Okay, so Batman and Jason follow Le Fay's trail to a castle in Britain. She animates suits of armor and escapes. While fighting them, Jason throws off his mortal body and assumes his demon form. Batman and Etrigan are joined by the rest of the League. Jean suggests that they try to locate Le Fay telepathically. As he reaches out, Le Fay seizes his mind and feeds it into an illusion. He suddenly sees himself on Mars. Before the war that destroyed it and reunited with his lost love and children, while Etrigan breaks the illusion and dispels. Working in parallel, both Le Fay and the League deduce two leads up to the stone, the archaeologist who excavated the castle several years ago. Batman, Jean, and Etrigan track down one, Henry Moss, who now teaches at a university. Along the way, Etrigan warns Batman that Jean cannot be trusted now, and Batman refuses to listen. At the same time, Wonder Woman and Flash go to a costume party being thrown by the other archaeologist, Harv Hickman, now a wealthy magazine tycoon.
Hugh Hefner!
It's Hugh Hefner, just yes. Very, very thinly veiled. At first, their superhero costumes fail to impress the guards, but Harv immediately takes a shine to Diana, calling her a goddess because of her beauty and revealing armor, kissed her hand, and lets her in. Morgane... Is it Morgan or Morgane?
Well,
because I go by the old.
I go by the old. I go by Morgane Le Fay is what has every time that I've read an Arthurian story, it's that's what it's been said. But apparently in DCAU, it's Morgane.
Oh.
At least in this two-parter, I'm going to have to look up kid stuff and see what it is in that. But
remember, kids don't mix up Morgane Le Fay with Le Morgane. Or Le Morgan. That'd just be horrible. So yeah, Morgan appears in Moss's home, who turns out to be Jean in disguise. Batman and Etrigan attack, but Morgan retaliates and hits Jean with another vision of his family. Jean hesitates, giving her the opening to seriously wound Batman and escape. Thoughts, good sir?
Well, I do have to point out that Jean's wife is voiced by Pam Grier in The Illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. First off, I love Arthurian stories, so that's a positive point in this two-parter. The Morgan Le Fay design reminds me of the chick in the BTAS episode Mean Seasons. I purposefully, because I've already grabbed the audio for this episode,
yep.
I purposefully grabbed the audio where Jason changes. Gone, gone, the form of man. Rise, the demon, Etrigan. I love that. That's just so awesome. Again, another awesome point is Batman with a sword.
Yes. And not just like... when I saw that, I was like, holy crap, is Batman a Skadian?
Wow.
What was up with the demons? Because they looked like they were escapees from Warworld. Not to bring up the episode that shall not be named, but...
Yeah, I know. It's probably reused animation, I'm not sure.
I don't think it is, but that'd be similar character design.
Might not be reused animation, but it might be similar character design. The first and only time we ever see Jean's family.
We finally get his wife's name, Myria.
Yeah, Myria is what he...
Oh, sorry.
Well, Myria. No, I mean, that's how it's spelled out, but he calls her Myria, but...
I just hastily chicken scratched it on my piece of paper, so...
Yes. I've said before that I watch, at the time I'd been doing, when I first started doing this podcast, I'd also been watching Alias on the side, and Carl Lumley, who voices Jean, is in that show. And this was the first episode, the only time that I can actually tell the difference between Jean's voice and Lumley's actual own voice was when he says, "My dear children." It sounded more of Lumley's own voice than it did... Now, I don't know, I've said this before, I don't know if they used some sort of vocal effect on his voice at all to have that metallic, robotic, alien type of sound. But that's the only time I was ever able to tell that it... I mean, obviously it's the same guy, but, you know,
yeah.
Just one of those things where, I picked it up. We already mentioned Hugh Hefner. And this is my last note on this one, but Jean is the dumbest Martian ever. I can see being under that spell of an illusion once, but three times?
Well, it brings up the fact that I wrote this down, that what type of closure does Jean really have?
None.
Because what happens? He goes to sleep, he wakes up suddenly, these monsters are attacking another planet, he tries to save them, and then he's on guard duty for the Justice League. I mean, what real closure does he have over the deaths of his family, his people, and his culture?
None, but again, you know...
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking that...
No, I understand where you're coming from, I truly do, because it also calls... It doesn't call back to it, it actually foreshadows the episode for The Man Who Has Everything, wherein that Mungul reappears and has this black mercy plant heart thingamabob that he puts on Superman, and it gives the wearer, you know, their heart's content, and it's Superman with a low Lana type of character. I don't think it's actually said whether it's Lois or Lana, but they're all on Krypton, they're married, they have a kid, they have somewhat of a crypto dog. I think the dog is actually called Crypto.
You like Crypto.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying I'm just going off my memory, because obviously that episode is way down the line for us. But it's the same thing here, where, you know, someone has used Jean, has used his memories of what he had against him or what he could have again. Same thing for Superman later on. But, you know, once is enough. He knew.
Oh, I agree.
He knew after, I would say, the second time. He knew that it was an illusion. He knew, you know, that it wasn't real. And I just wish they wouldn't have done it two other times.
I'm totally with you there. I mean, he should have known better.
But
and as a character, that is not something that he should have done.
True.
Even with the complete lack of closure that he has had as a character. I mean, honestly, if, you know, my parents were suddenly coming back to life in an illusion, I'd be like, okay, I know this ain't real, you know. Sorry, not going to fall for this one.
Yeah.
You know, I will honestly say that I would be taken back and I would not react as quickly or something like that, but I can't really sit there and say that I would be faced by it multiple times.
Yeah, exactly. I think, what else do you have for part one?
Let's see, I put down, like, the question of who the voice of Morgan Le Fay was. And it's the same voice actress, is it Elizabeth Dabo?
No, it's Olivia Dabo.
Olivia Dabo.
Yeah.
Who does Star Sapphire, which is why I was like, the hell does that voice? It sounds so familiar and I really like it.
Yeah.
Huh. What else? Okay, Mordred is a complete little shit.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me once we get to kid stuff, he becomes an even more little shit.
Like, the point where he was playing, effectively Doom.
Yeah.
I was like, what the hell is going on here? The fact that we've got this really insanely powerful telepath, right? He's Martian. They speak through telepathy. You know, it's a natural occurring thing, and he is pretty damn powerful when it comes to the DCAU.
Right.
And Morgan Le Fay suddenly says, oh, it's a rank amateur. It's like, oh, crap, you know, who the hell are they really fighting here?
Well, alright, I can kind of discount it because there's a difference between having telepathic powers and having magical powers. I mean, that's like Superman being hit in the face with Hot Girl's mace. I mean, the magic is going to affect him, unlike anything else can, because he's one of Superman's weaknesses is magic. So, you know, that's one way I can kind of, I see where you're coming from, but I can also kind of discount it because she uses fucking magic.
Okay, but then it's a question of what type of telepathy is it? Is it naturally occurring, or is it magical based, or is it, I mean, you've got Jean, who's got the naturally occurring, because that seems to be a trait of Martians.
Right.
So, I don't know.
I don't know.
Moss, the poor guy, he's just chilling out at home. And never mind that he looks like one of the, like, red herring villains from Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, he's going to be the bad guy. He must have stolen it.
Yes, he does. That's kind of sad, actually.
He kind of sees Etrigan, and the poor guy, like, nearly dies.
Yeah, he goes into shock. But, to be fair, Etrigan didn't really give him any choice not to go into shock.
This is true. This is Etrigan we're talking about. All the costumes that we saw at Hugh Hefner's place, I mean, the guy that was dressed up like a really bad Aquaman...
Yeah,
with the little inflatable ring and the old school Super Friends costume. And I don't know if it was intentional, but one of the guys in the toga made me think of Maxi Zeus.
I'm actually on the wiki for this episode. The costumes at the party. Batman closely resembling an actor of 50 years later. Maxi Zeus, like you said, an old style Aquaman. Dr. Bedlam, Black Racer. Vykin the Black. I don't know if I'm pronounced. I mean, I don't. It's V-Y-K-I-N, so I'm not sure what. Let's see. Goody Rickles, a parody of Don Rickles. OMAC, Faceless Agents. Harley Quinn and Devilance the Pursuer.
Yep, I saw the Harley Quinn in the second part, and I was like, "Ooh, it's Harley!" And that is something that I could see Harley actually like crashing into.
Interesting note on this one. I was looking, because I usually, like, episodes like this and, like, Legends, I try to look at the credits for the voice actors to see on the DVD who played who without actually having to go to the wiki. But, obviously, I'm not watching the DVD at the moment. Interesting enough, the Michael Goff that voiced Henry Moss should not be confused with Michael Goff, or Goff, or however the hell you say his damn name, the Michael Goff that played Alfred in 1989 Batman, because it's not the same person. Okay. It's same name, but it's completely different people.
Because, you know, it's kind of like someone that's Michael something something.
Yeah.
God knows, there's enough of us Michaels.
You throw a stone, you can hit at least six of us. And it also should be noted that, where is it? Oh, here it is. Billy Zane originally voiced Etrigan in the new Batman Adventures episode, The Demon Within.
Wow.
He is replaced in this episode by Michael T. Weiss. Michael T. Weiss, a lot of people know
as... From The Pretender.
Yep.
And Howling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that. I couldn't tell that was him.
You can probably tell more as Jason Blood than you can as Etrigan, though.
Yeah.
You have anything else for this one?
Not for part one, I don't think.
Alright, I guess we can move into part two unless you have anything else.
Actually, there was a point where Jean was talking, and it reminded me not of Jean or any other voice actor, but of the opening for The Outer Limits.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the wonderful tagline of the Flash talking to Diana and saying, "Oh, yes, I know of it, but I only read it for the articles."
Yeah.
Should we start on to part two?
Yes.
Okay, so in part two, Batman awakes in the Watchtower's infirmary. Etrigan is left to join Wonder Woman, but Jean is there and apologizes, confessing that the need to see his family alive again was almost too much for him to resist. At Hickman's party, Diana is inwardly repulsed by Harve's narrow, self-centered views, but plays up the role of a vacuous model type to convince him to show her the stone. While he confides it is the source of his wealth and fame, just then Morgan arrives, and Diana grabs the stone, and Morgan transforms Hickman into a giant worm creature to attack her. There's so many puns to go with that, but...
Yeah, let's abstain from that. I think my hot wing sex thing was was the pun of the episode.
Diana grabs the stone, and Morgan transforms... Okay, so Diana and Flash fight against the creature, but Etrigan arrives and tells Diana to run, getting the stone as far away from Morgan as possible while he holds her off. Diana reluctantly obeys, while Flash evacuates the party guests. When Diana escapes, Morgan's rage causes a magical blast powerful enough to vaporize the whole and mercifully empty mansion. Hickman returns to normal, stumbles out of the wreckage in his shorts, and faints.
We should also mention before you continue, the neighbor.
The neighbor. Do we know who the neighbor was supposed to be?
No, we don't, but I could only assume it's supposed to be some celebrity.
So, the stone is picked up by the Watchtower secure... locked up in the Watchtower secure vault, and Flash congratulates his team on a mission accomplished. Etrigan, of course, refuses to relax. A short time later, the Watchtower's lights go out, and Morgan's demonic soldiers appear. Etrigan, Batman, Flash, and Wonder Woman defeat them with difficulty. When the dust settles, they see that the stone is gone, and Jean has left the Watchtower in the Javelin. Morgan makes her new base in London, magically transforming a museum into a medieval castle. Jean arrives, and is about to hand the stone to her when the League arrives via a magic portal opened by Etrigan. The League attacks, but are barely a match for Morgan's magic, and Mordred soon reveals his own powers. Etrigan tries to overpower Jean, who says that Morgan has promised to use the stone's power to resurrect all of Mars, including his family. Etrigan scorns this as a lie, but Jean fights back with desperation and manages to surprisingly defeat the demon. Morgan and Mordred manage to hold the rest of the League at bay, and she calls Jean to her. Jean surveys the destruction of the room and the state of his teammates. As Morgan reaches out to take the stone, he crushes it into a powder. Shocked, she tells him that he has given up his only chance for happiness. He says the price was too high. Morgan withdraws with her son, assuring him that they have lost the battle but not the war. The building returns to normal. The League recover from the fight, and Jason has reverted to his human form. Jean announces that he is resigning from the League, and as his teammates can no longer rely on him. Unexpectedly, Jason is the one who urges him to remain, seeing that Jean, unlike himself, was ultimately able to resist Morgan's temptation. Jason takes his leave and walks into the fog, cursed to keep seeking Morgan until she is defeated. Jean hopes that he will find peace one day.
You know, one of the bad things about listening to a podcast and then doing a podcast on the exact same topic is you're going to have overlapping
ideas
and notes, and I really don't want to steal anything from World's Finest Podcast, but they've already covered this episode. They're well into Season 2 of Justice League already. They mentioned that, and it's a good point, we never actually find out until, obviously, the next episode. You know, this is left as a cliffhanger at the end of Part 2, whether Jean resigns or not. This is also very indicative of Starcrossed, the season finale of Season 2. Because, I mean, Jean did the same thing Hot Girl does. He pretty much doomed the world when he's under this spell.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is, you know, world-conquering, castle-changing stuff that these sorcerers or sorceries or whatever the hell you want to call the plural of it, you know...
Sorcery?
Yes, sorcery.
Well, okay, since we're also including Mordred in this, it would be sorcerers.
Yeah, true. Did you catch the Beanie and Cecil reference?
No, I didn't.
There's an old cartoon, my mom used to love it, but that's what, when Harv gets turned into a worm, Flash makes some comment about, oh, okay, Cecil, or something, and it's a reference to this kid Beanie and his pet, I'll have to look it up, but yeah, that's what that's a reference to. Again, the fact that Jean can't get out of this spell is just pissing... As I was watching it, it just kept pissing me off.
Yeah, it was... I felt it was a disservice to the character, honestly.
Yeah.
Because he is such a strong backbone, and he is the heart of the Justice League. But now we're seeing him as someone that can't separate this fantasy of something that he really wants from reality of what's really going on, and what is going to affect his new family.
Yep.
And all of his friends.
Yep. Flash uses his super duper speed to destroy the monsters with Edrigan's freezing power. We find out later...
I don't understand how that worked.
Well, the thing is, though, it just goes to show you how sometimes inept Wally can be, because Etrigan's like, Flash, we need a maelstrom. A what?
What?
A whirlwind. Start running really, really fast. And he's like, faster, faster. And we will see later that Flash, if he goes extremely fast, bad shit can happen.
Oh, yes.
Horrible, horrible shit can happen.
That's the power of the Speed Force.
Yes. Go ahead.
So this is the first time we've actually seen him get pushed to really run fast.
Yep.
And I don't know at this point, I don't think he knows how fast he really can go. Half the time he's just kind of like, oh, can't catch up to this speeding armored car. I'm the Flash, I'm not going too fast.
Yeah, you know, I think this is where he starts to get a little bit more characterization. I believe, of course, I'm probably going to have to retract this as we continue the coverage on Justice League, but I believe this is the only episode in the entire series where Jean uses his hardening his hardened ability.
I saw that. I'm like, I knew he had it. I knew he had it.
Yeah, I knew he had it too, but I didn't ever remember seeing him use it.
It was like, we talked about it in one of the prior episodes, and you're like, yeah, I don't think it ever shows up. I'm like, ha, there it is.
Yep. And then after using it on the demon, he kicks him like a little girl, like a little, one of those little, like, I'm better than you type of kicks.
Don't mess with me and get my family.
And of course, Batman fighting a dog chair, I guess, is the best way to...
Honestly, God, it made me think of, my mind just dropped. Willow.
Oh, from Buffy, yeah.
No, Willow, like the old movie from the 80s.
Where, oh!
Like, the sorceress, like, enchants the furniture to, like, go attack people. I'm like, really? And it just seemed very... In comparison to his mother, it seemed very rough. Like, obviously this kid has not been doing this for as long as his mom.
Yeah. Well, then again, you know, he is still kind of a kid, so...
Little shit.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. He is a little shit.
I was really hoping that somewhere in the episode, Batman would just, like, go up and just smack him. Like, stop being a little bitch.
Oh, believe me, Batman doesn't get in, like, smacking him, but he gets in a few good lines on him in once we get to kids' stuff.
Let's see, got anything else?
Not unless you do.
The guy that thinks of the snake gets turned into a snake.
Yeah, Harv.
I saw that, and then I was thinking of Dante's Inferno, and the... this is where they got that idea. The scene where he's showing her around, and he's like, oh, this really great Greek statue, and she's like, it's Roman. I'm sorry? No, it's Roman. It's a Roman copy. He's like, hell, how do you know? I'm like,
Flash is like, she knows, trust me, she knows.
Yeah. She can tell the difference. So when Morgan blows up the mansion, I'm like, wow, someone's got a really bad case of PMS. Ah. Again, Morgan, little shits. Okay, so when is the magic lasso that she has conductive?
That does not come into play until Justice League Unlimited.
Because she sends up that magical energy throw. I'm like, wait, it's conductive?
Oh, okay. I
don't know. It was like, wow, okay. I figured there'd be like a prevent feedback thing going on there, you know?
Well, the other thing is, as I thought you were meaning as far as when does Diana start using it, like...
Oh, no.
I know, but...
Like the old 1960s.
Right, really, right. But what I'm saying is that, you know, what I was going to say was that because she stole her armor and weapon back in Paradise Lost, she doesn't know of its actual true power, and she won't know until we get to...
Season 2?
No, Justice League Unlimited, the episode where, I believe it's the episode that the Annihilator's in.
Okay.
Or something. It might not be the Annihilator episode, it's the one where they have to go rescue, Hades from Faust taking over, or something. I don't know, it's one convoluted thing, I'll tell you off the air.
Okay. Let's see what else, okay, so Etrigan's using fire on a spaceship. maybe it's great for him because he's immortal, but what about everybody else that's still stuck on there? And then how exactly did Etrigan know that she was a princess?
Well, she does have the giant tiara with a star on her head.
Yes, she's also got, like, you know, the stripper uniform, too, but... It doesn't necessarily say princess to me. I mean, honestly, speaking from my experience with royalty, you don't normally wear a tiara every day.
Well, it's... She's a superhero.
Even when you got some queens running around, they don't...
Well, and see, that's the other thing. There really is no secret identity for Diana in the Justice League. There never is.
I don't understand where... how Etrigan would be privy to that information unless Bats is like, hey, you know what, I got this sweet thing with the princess, something might happen.
Well, he could have been that way, I don't know, but I was going to say, well, it's the goddamn Etrigan.
The line where Etrigan's like, well, what happens if, you know, if Jean does betray you, are you willing to take him down? In essence, and Batman's like, I will do anything that it takes.
Yeah,
anything.
Whatever it takes.
And
that's...
that...
Go ahead.
I don't know if you've read it, but there was a storyline in Justice League of America in the comic a while back called The Tower of Babel, where every one of the Justice League members were taken down, and they were taken down by Batman's designs. Like, they were all his plans that were on the Batcomputer.
Right. I've never read Tower of Babel. I want to, but I haven't read it yet. But yeah, I mean, the whatever it takes thing is pretty much, it's at least through the DCAU, it's Batman's mantra now. Even in Batman Beyond, it's like whatever it takes for, you know, to get the mission done.
It's kind of frightening, honestly. But that line made me think of that, and I'm like, oh god, he's going to have those incinerating nanites that he's going to throw on John.
Yeah.
What else do we have? Yeah, so I'm glad they reverted Big Ben back from a flaming tower.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I honestly really liked this episode, except for, okay, I like the story, I just don't like the whole Jean thing that we've already covered.
But. Yeah, that was the only downer for me, was the whole Jean thing. And I'm not sure if you noticed, did you notice an animation flub with Etrigan?
No.
When they're in the tower, and he's sitting on whatever he's sitting on, and the lights go out, his shape, actually James from Once Upon a Time's podcast pointed this out in their episode, but his shape changes without him moving. I don't know if it's the colors on his design or whatever, but like when the lights are on, he's one color. When they go off, it's like his whole model shifted without him actually moving.
Behold the power of being a demon.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Something I do want to bring up though is a lot of the facial shots and stuff of Etrigan. Now, mind you, what we've seen in this episode, and it'll come up prevalent in the next episode. I don't know if they're going for a specific art style to go back to the comics or whatnot to make it more noticeable, or people that might be fans of the comics and they might be drawn into, oh, hey, there's an episode with so-and-so in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the character design and the art style when in certain shots harken to Hellboy style.
Yeah, they kind of do.
It was like, I don't like that art style personally, but it just made me think of that when they were doing the face shots, especially in the first part of the episode during the prologue.
Right.
And whenever he would transform.
Yeah, well, you know, I will say this now, Etrigan rules, but but baby Etrigan in kid stuff rules even more.
Okay.
All right, we are going to move on.
Mace, where are you?
Right here. I knew you were jealous, but I never thought you'd go this far.
I don't know what you're talking about.
No? See if this jogs your memory.
Are you getting this, Jabba? I want them to see what my creation can really do.
Whoa!
It might even have military applications.
I won't let you take her from me.
Mace, you're making a big mistake.
No, you did.
Ah! and it will be your last, old friend.
And finally up today, we have Metamorphosis. Oh God, kill me now.
It's not as bad as That Which Shall Not Be Named.
No, it's not as bad as That Shall Not... No, it's not as bad as that, but it gets pretty bad later on in Part 2. But anyway, to start Part 1, Simon Stagg, who we don't know who the hell he is until later, but shows a group of investors footage of a recent industrial accident suffered at one of their oil rigs and says he has the perfect solution. Metamorpho, a genetically mutated human able to survive under hostile conditions. Stagg says that he has perfected the theory and is only awaiting a human subject to test it on. The investors are skeptical and demand proof. Aboard a commuter train, Stagg's henchman, Java. Now, I could have sworn when I was watching this, he called him Jabba, as in Jabba the Hutt. No, seriously.
I wasn't sure, honestly.
I'm not sure either, so I'm going to have to go back and look in the DVD credits and check it. He is carrying a briefcase of mutagenic chemicals toward the city, which Stagg tells him not to let out of his sight, but as soon as Jabba... I'm just going to call him Jabba, as in Jabba the Hutt. It sounds a lot better than a cup of coffee. It just does. Hangs up. An attendant tells him that personal luggage is not allowed and he'll have to stow it. Confused, Jabba surrenders the briefcase and is placed in the luggage compartment. Before long, the train's vibrations spill the chemicals inside and the reaction with the train's hull causes it to derail. Green Lantern arrives to minimize the crash. Yeah, minimize. He couldn't actually freaking stop it. Again, these rings are supposed to be all freaking powerful, and he couldn't freaking stop it. Oh, jeez. While he is examining the train, he is hailed by a familiar voice and is surprised to see his old Marine Corps comrade, Rex Mason. Mason says he is now a high-placed executive with Stagg Enterprises and was also a passenger on the train. Rex invites John back to his apartment for a drink. John is a little taken aback by his friend's luxurious rooftop apartment and even more taken aback to meet Rex's very beautiful fiancée, Sapphire Stagg. Rex says they are in love, though they have kept their relationship a secret from Simon. While they are talking, John receives a call from Batman, who is investigating the... And I love how Batman just sneaks in. That was so awesome. That was just, like, so awesome. It's like... Oh, the police and everybody else is over here. Doot, 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 zoom! has discovered traces of the mutagen. John confronts Rex, who claims ignorance, and the two men part on a bad note. Rex confronts Simon, who tells him not to worry. Rex is angry because the chemicals Jabba was carrying are illegal, and Simon expects him to shut up about it. He informs Simon that he's decided to quit Stagg Enterprises and take a job in another city. Later, when Simon pays a surprise visit to his daughter's apartment, he is surprised to find Rex there. She tells her father that she is going to go with Rex. Simon pretends acceptance, but is furious. The next night, while Rex is clearing out his desk, a security alarm sounds from a science lab, and security doesn't answer his call. So he goes down in to investigate himself and is lured into a chamber where he is doused with the mutagen. Like, we didn't see that plot device coming. When he regains his consciousness in a hospital bed, Simon and Sapphire are standing over him, looking horrified. He looks in the mirror and sees himself transformed into a multicolored mutant. Screaming, he rushes out into the night. This is very much like the Two-Face two-parter from BTAS. This whole episode, this first part, because, you know, you have... Back then you had Harvey Dent going into this chemical plant and chemicals get spilt on him, and his fiancée Grace ends up running out of the hospital room after seeing his deformed face. So very, very similar to the BTAS episode Two-Face. Out on the street, he wanders in front of a truck and is splattered all over the front. To the police and the driver's shock, the splattered remains reform into Mason. Alarmed, the police open fire and the bullets bounce off his body like rubber. Lantern follows the reports to the accident site, where Stagg, Jabba, and Sapphire are listening to the police give their report. Sapphire begs John to find Rex before the police do, and he promises. Jabba, who is taking pictures, snaps a shot that makes it seem as though John and she are embracing. Simon returns to his office and finds Mason sitting at his desk, having reviewed his project files on Metamorpho, and realized that what happened was no accident. Mason demands the truth, but Simon distracts him with the photo, tricking Mason into believing that John has stolen his girlfriend behind his back. John enlists the rest of the League to helping him track down Mason. They are interrupted by a bank robbery as they pursue the robbers. Lantern easily stops the truck and disables two of the robbers, but misses a third, and Hot Girl has to intervene before John is shot in the back. John admits that he is distracted, confessing to her that he is having misgivings about the choices he has made. Had he taken a different path, he might be where Rex is now. Then Rex calls him, saying they need to meet. John flies to meet him at the chemical plant owned by Stagg. As soon as he arrives, Rex attacks, now believing that his old friend has betrayed him. Against the full range of Mason's new powers, the ability to mimic any chemical reaction, John is helpless and knocked unconscious. Dun dun dun. Yeah, Metamorpho. No.
He leaves a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah, no. You know, at first I thought I didn't. It's been a while since I watched this episode. Not since I watched it for obviously this recording, but before that, when it starts out and we see the workers, I thought that was actual part of the story, not a TV film thing. The workers just stand there till an explosion goes off. What the hell? They're running around like, oh my god, it's gonna blow. You gotta stop it. Why not just run and get the hell out of there and let the damn thing blow up? Don't just stand there as it's blowing up, you dumbasses. Isn't this the guy? Oh, okay. I'm going to have to look this up, but my note was, isn't the guy who voices Braddock, the head honcho at the beginning, the same guy that voiced Two-Face in BTAS? Because I think it is. Rex flirts with the train attendant, but yet he's supposedly so in love with Sapphire.
There's nothing wrong with being flirtatious, as long as you don't take it too far.
Oh, yeah. But she does fall into his lap, so...
That's true.
Slicing the van in half. That ring is awesome.
Oh, he can do that, but he can't stop a train.
I know, exactly. It's kind of one-sided there. And that's my final note on this first episode. So what do you have, sir?
Okay. Well, we see Java, and... If you've been keeping up with some of the geek news lately, mm-hmm. It made me think of Kevin Smith. I'm like, oh, someone's going to need two seats. let's see. Congrats, you're mining for a few barrels of oil. Oh, look, you found methane instead. Yeah, made more money. let's see. I didn't quite understand if he's pulling that train backwards. How the hell did it go from going off on the rails through the train station? I didn't understand that at all.
Yeah.
Did he try lifting it up and going, oh shit, this is too heavy?
Yeah.
Why didn't he make another set of train tracks to, stop the train from going through anything? It seemed kind of...
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that they were trying not to have John use constructs until later, so...
It's just like, come on, John. You've got better brains than that.
Well, true.
Again, we see the really bad... I won't say bad. We see the art style that beckons back to the original original comics way back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. where we've got these overly accentuated details in the face and the bodies and the really over-the-top eyebrows.
Right.
And it turns my stomach when I see this.
Yeah.
We see a lot of violence in this episode. We see the guy get hit by a vehicle, and we see what really happens to people when they get hit by a vehicle that's speeding. They go splat, quite literally. There isn't much left of the person. And we see this in this episode, and it's perfectly fine because he reconstitutes. We see the police actually firing at them and the bullets hitting him, only to bounce out, but still, we see police violence.
Yeah.
And it's interesting considering when we think back to the prior episodes with Enemy Below and whatnot, they know how to skate around at, what they can get away with and what they can't when it comes to violence on this show.
Yeah.
So my hat is off to them for that. Rex is just stupid. Oh, I'm going to go in. There's no security. Really, what company would allow any former employee into the building without an escort security-wise to anywhere, especially if they're higher up?
True.
Last night.
True.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I've got. Oh, wait, being hit, beaten in the head with a bedpan, that has got to hurt.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, I forgot about the bedpan thing. I'm looking at the casting on the wiki here. Wow. Tom Sizemore voiced Rex Mason / Metamorpho.
Tom Sizemore, huh?
Wow. But I was looking for the guy that... guess who's in this episode as one of the background characters?
Oh, who is it?
It's not actually it's not a superhero, it's just one of the general, it's the NTSB inspector when the train collapses or crashes or whatever.
Yeah.
Guess who voices him?
Who?
Michael Bell.
Oh, God.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Sideswipe has crossed over. Alright, getting into part two here, yeah. As Rex prepares to kill John, the rest of the League arrives and fights him, but is able to outmatch all of them, even Superman, when he transforms a piece of his arm to emit kryptonite radiation. As the battle goes on, Simon and Jabba, I'm still calling him Jabba, I'm not calling him a cup of coffee, are sitting in a nearby van filming the whole thing. Eventually, Rex decides to run and slips away. Wow. Run and slip away. Yeah, that doesn't jive too well for me. He returns to Sapphire and angrily confronts her about her quote-unquote affair. Shocked and angry, she tells him he's been fooled and that she still loves him in despite of whatever he's become. Realizing that Simon has played him, Rex rushes out again. Simon shows his investors the footage of quote-unquote Metamorpho defeating the Justice League, and they are now eager to buy. Simon confides to Jabba, they are now in the process has been proven, he can create a better Metamorpho and doesn't need Mason anymore. Mason arrives in time to hear this and is ready to kill Simon, but Jabba stops him by spraying him with liquid nitrogen, freezing him solid. Okay, that didn't work out too well. Well, he breaks free later. Sapphire calls John and tells him the latest. John reassures her that, and is surprised to hear from her, that Rex has followed his career avidly and even been jealous of him, the selfless hero. The two of Simon's thugs plan to dump the frozen Mason somewhere, but he thaws out first and escapes the truck. He rushes to Stagg Enterprises' lab, where Simon is preparing a fresh batch of the mutagen with virtual reality control device wired to a headset. Mason swears that Simon won't do the same thing to another person, and smashes the controls. Did they explode? I don't remember.
Probably.
While his headset is still wired to the chemicals, the feedback causes Simon to scream and collapse. To Mason's shock, the chemicals come to life, forming a huge lumbering monster. John and Batman arrive at the lab site and find both Stagg and Mason. Mason apologizes for his earlier rampage and says they need his help. Lance flies off with him while Batman stays behind to analyze the chemical residue. In downtown Metropolis, Superman, Hawkgirl, and John Jones try to stop the creature, but it is too resilient. When Lantern and Mason arrive, they share what they know, and John says that he can sense a limited primal intelligence within the creature. Mason theorizes that the monster has absorbed part of Simon's mind, meaning he is acting on Simon's desires, and becomes horrified when he realizes that the monster is after Sapphire. In their apartment, Sapphire is watching the news of the huge creature defeating the Justice League. Then the creature itself arrives and grabs her and starts climbing up the side of a tall skyscraper. Oh, God. King Kong, really?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, come on, King Kong?
Damn. Well, Metamorpho did make the comment of, oh, I wish, what I wouldn't do for some biplanes right now.
The entire league plus Mason tries to rescue her, but the creature is still too tough. Then Batman calls, saying he has analyzed the formula and that they can destroy it using a designer amino acid. The problem is it'll take days to make enough of it. Mason proposes a radical alternative. He can morph his body into the acid and combine himself with the creature. When Lantern objects that this would be suicide, Mason gasses him unconscious, saying they don't have time to argue. Rex climbs up the building and confronts the creature, telling it to let Sapphire go. Taking on Simon's face, it refuses. With the last I love you to Sapphire, Rex morphs into the amino acid, dives down into the creature's throat, and the acid blossoms outward. In his hospital bed, Stag bolts upright, screaming. As the creature writhes, it drops Sapphire. John wakes up just in time to see her fall and catches her, and they watch as the creature explodes. Seeing nothing left of the creature or Rex except dregs, Sapphire sobs against John's shoulder. The League assembles on the balcony of the apartment to console Sapphire, and John says Rex was a true hero. As Sapphire cries, one of her tears falls into a puddle of the chemical, which begins to rise from the ground. To the other's amazement, it resolves itself into Rex, alive but not unscathed. Wouldn't want to do that again. As Sapphire throws herself to his arms, Hot Girl winks at John, still regretting the road not taken. Seeing the happy couple, he rejoins, what do you think?
The Flash?
Yeah, I actually, I don't know what I was doing this past weekend when I was doing the research for these episodes, because for some strange reason, I didn't actually finish watching this one. I don't know why. Normally,
you're not supposed to admit that on the air.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, what, huh? Because I could have sworn I went back and I did my notes and did my due diligence, but apparently not. I guess it just goes to show you how bad this two-parter is. It's not as bad as that episode that shall not be named, but it's still, meh. So what do you have for thoughts there, sir?
Okay, the first part of the episode when the two, quote, friends are beating the crap out of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Superman just comes down and takes, like, the fire right to his chest. He's like, oh, I'll take care of this. And Superman's actually super for a while. Like, he's beating the crap out of Metamorpho. He's like, oh, look, fire. Yes, that's going to do much. Wham! You know, until the whole
kryptonite thing.
Kryptonite radiation, that it was like, all right, we got some real Superman for once. Woo! I do have down Simon's little creature. It's a giant walking booger.
Yep.
Never mind that they're accusing Metamorpho of this. And it's like, wait, Batman, the world's greatest detective, doesn't seem to, you know, get news feeds or information about a giant walking snot monster. Really?
Yeah.
Really? No, there's no news flashes or Jean up in the watchtower, you know.
Where's Snapper? Yeah, I was going to say, where's Snapper Carr when you really need him?
And what else? Okay, Hot Girl throwing her mace at the monster and it does nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote down, see, no good comes from throwing away your magic mace. You don't do that. I was lost as to how Metamorpho could get through an energy field of the Green Lantern ring. Like, he just turned into gas and went right through. I'm like, really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? How, that's supposed to protect people in space.
Yeah.
How?
It's one of those things where they're not real consistent with the ring's powers.
Yeah.
You know. It's you can really attest to this more than I can, but just my own personal opinion, the Green Lantern rings are supposed to be this all-powerful thing, and
they're up there. Like, there's a background story of a Sinestro Corps member, and for those that don't know, Sinestro Corps is the evil version of Green Lanterns, basically. Except they use the color yellow.
Right.
there was a Green Lantern that went down to his home planet, found that it was completely dead. Every living thing was destroyed. And he couldn't find the source of it, and he had his shields up for, I think it was 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had to take his shields down to recharge.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up dying because of a sentient virus that was waiting that entire time for him to drop his shield.
Ugh,
if a virus, a microscopic virus cannot go through a shield, I fail to understand how
gas could.
Gas. And, yeah. And a solid head at that can get through there.
Yeah, that's true. Again, it just goes to show you what kind of a plot device the Green Lantern ring is in this series.
It's a MacGuffin muffin.
Oh, yeah, it will definitely become a MacGuffin because once we get to Season 2's finale, yeah.
So I have proof that this guy is not Jabba, but Java.
Okay.
In one scene, he's sitting there having to pour coffee.
Oh, God. I still prefer to think of him as DCAU's version of Jabba the Hutt, but that's just me.
I felt bad for him, like, halfway through this whole story arc. He's getting crapped on left and right, beaten on. And
I felt bad for him up to the point where he had the liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, and even then, like, this super intelligent, like, guy is coming up with this metamorpho prospect.
Yeah.
He freezes metamorpho. Oh, little science fact, you know, everything stops at sub-zero temperatures. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, but he doesn't keep him on ice.
Yeah, exactly.
What happens when you've got an ice cube in a warm environment? Gee, I wonder. And then something that really bothered me, like, mind you, they were both in the Marines, but you've got someone that's just got superpowers.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, oh, I guess you could come along. Ho, ho, ho. Never mind Wonder Woman, who shows up in the first episode, is beating the crap out of things. Is, you know, Miss Amazon has more warrior experience, and he's all like, no, you're a rookie. Tuh. And I don't know if it was like a sexist thing in the first episode or what, but he's allowing someone that's just got these uncontrollable powers to become, you know, part of the team to help out.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is, there's, I'm looking at the wiki page here, and there's continuity listed, and hereafter, John proposes Metamorpho as a new member of the League to replace, apparently, fallen Superman. And then in Unlimited, when we go Unlimited, in Initiation, Metamorpho is indeed shown as a member of the Expanded League. And then, as far as tribute to Rex Mason, in yeah. Justice League Unlimited, the Once in Future Thing Part 2, Time Warped, Warhawk, last seen in Batman Beyond, The Call, reveals himself as John's son, Rex Stewart, a strong indicator that he is named after Mason.
Wow.
So, is that all we have for...
That's all I've got.
Alright. Yeah, that's all, folks.
This is the quote of Episode 4.
Hey, Cookie.
One word and you'll be the fastest man alive with a limp.
Thank you for joining us here on the Secret Origins Podcast. There are several ways to get in contact with us or leave feedback for the show. First is you can stop by geekcastradio.com, find all the other podcasts there. Second is you can join our forums at predaconempire.com/nexus. And the third is you can leave the show feedback in iTunes. I'm going to have to check and see if we have any feedback in iTunes yet, even though we're only 4 episodes in. We have a voicemail line. Call us and leave us your thoughts on each episode. Be sure to say which show you're leaving the message for and your name. The number is 502-526-5821. You can follow us on Twitter. The show name there is Secret Origins. Mine is TFG and Mike, and what is your Twitter?
Caminiti Style. CaminitiStyle.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Secret Origins Podcast. Wish you'll join us next time when we will be doing the season finale of Season 1, The Savage Time. For now, I am TFG and Mike with
Lupus Convoy.
Until next time.